Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act is currently being debated at the U.S. Supreme Court, today we look at a side issue that is concerning medical professionals. If 30 to 40 million more Americans will have health insurance, who will they see as a primary care physician? Well, when this question is posed, it's usually stated in a way as if these newly insured had never seen a doctor before. Of course, they have. But without a doubt, they will utilize the system in a new way, which will create additional strain on an already stretched primary care system. My guest today has written about the shortage in primary care physicians in this month's copy of The Atlantic. He's Dr. John Henning Schumann, an associate professor of medicine at OU Tulsa's School of Community Medicine. Recently came here from the University of Chicago. He's also the associate director of the Internal Medicine Residence Program. He's written about the shortage of internal medicine physicians going into primary care. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Dr. John Schumann, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We switch you from your commentator role to actually talking about this new article you did for The Atlantic, which looks at the shortage in primary care physicians. Your story asks right off the bat, we're going to see probably 30 million odd Americans who will have health insurance that didn't before through the Affordable Care Act. We may not have a way of really treating them in a cost-efficient way because of the shortage of primary care physicians. How acute is the shortage?
Well, it's estimated right now, credible reports, that the shortage is somewhere on the order of 30,000 primary care physicians sort of as we speak, and that's only going to get worse in 2014 when the main body of the Affordable Care Act sort of goes live. And the cost estimates look and say that about 30 million out of the almost 50 million Americans who are not insured will then enter the insured pool. And that's great in theory, right? If you give more insurance, more people will putatively have access to care. But if there's nobody to see them, we don't have outlets for them to enter into the medical system, then.
Yeah, well, not only from just not being able to find a doctor with insurance, if you have insurance and you can't find a doctor. From the healthcare law perspective, it's pretty problematic because you're depending on primary care physician to deliver health care at the most economical level, which if I go to my primary care physician when I start having a really bad cough as opposed to when it's developing in pneumonia and I go to the emergency room, you know, that's a lot cheaper.
Yeah, and it's been very well studied. I'm not a healthcare economist by any stretch of the imagination, but I read a lot of that literature. And the folks that study that and do comparative studies amongst nations, you know, we have vastly the most expensive healthcare system in the world by a lot. And countries, it's obviously politically challenging to talk about it, but in Western Europe where they do have a more socialized form of medicine and provide basic primary and preventive care services to their citizens, those countries spend a lot less but get actually better health outcomes when you measure outcomes, as you point out. So if you treat a cough early and prevent a hospitalization, you've saved an enormous amount of money, not to mention what we call morbidity for the patient, suffering basically.
Yeah. So we have about a 30,000 shortage at this particular point of primary care physicians. And this is despite, as you write, that there's an increase of medical schools. We've had new medical schools open and enrollment is up for the most part around the country. Class sizes are larger. So in theory, we should be turning out more doctors and probably are turning out more doctors.
Well, we're definitely turning out more doctors from the school side of things. And you're right. The number of medical schools has gone up for a long time from, I'd say, the early 70s. For about two decades, there were about exactly 126 medical schools. Don't ask me why I remember that number. And the number of schools is now up to 149. There's been a pretty big expansion of the number of osteopathic medical schools. Those are, you know, the turnout DOs. Mm-hmm. And in the MD or allopathic world, they've also expanded the number of schools. And as you also point out, the class sizes have grown. There's only one medical school that I know that's actually shrunk its class size. That's at the University of Chicago, where I previously was. But many other medical schools have expanded their class sizes. The bottleneck comes in post-medical school training, what we call graduate medical education, and that's like residency programs where you've gone to school, you've gotten your MD degree or your DO degree, you then have to undergo a period of training, which typically is 3 years. You know, they still have the internship, which is that first year, but almost all everybody, there's very few people who still will hang out their shingle after 1 year. For the vast majority of med school graduates, they'll go into a 3 or more year residency program to choose a specialty. And the problem is those spots haven't expanded since 1997. The Balanced Budget Act passed during the Clinton years capped the number of residency slots in the United States. And we've seen some slight increase with lots of political maneuvering. But basically, you have more medical school graduates competing for fewer spots. And so what that's done is put the squeeze on people from other countries that want to come and train in the United States. There's still a huge demand for that. And then we have a lot of American students who go to what are called offshore medical schools, usually in the Caribbean or in Mexico. And it's getting harder and harder for them on a competitive basis to match into those residency slots.
Now, once you finish a residency, can you still go into sort of primary care? Or generally, if you go through a residency, you pick a specialty and that's sort of what you do?
Yeah, so you certainly can go into primary care. And one of the things I lament in the article is it seems like nobody's really doing that anymore. I mean, that's what I practice is primary care. I have a specialty, which is the specialty of internal medicine. I spent 3 years in a residency program and then passed a board certification exam. So I'm a board certified internist. I chose not to go on and subspecialize for a variety of reasons, but the fields in which I could have gone into would be gastroenterology or cardiology. Those require an additional 3 years of training. Now, at the end of that, being a subspecialist, typically you'll get a much higher salary, and usually you have a narrower scope of problems. And often if you're an interventionalist, you get to do procedures. That part of that is it pays better. And for people who like to work with their hands or do procedures, that's a sort of better career choice. But primary care is also defined broadly. So it's internal medicine physicians who are like myself, but also family doctors. So the family doctor has sort of a loose definition, but there's a specialty called family practice, which also those folks also do a 3-year residency program leading to their own board certification from the American Board of Family Practice. And they cover, they're sort of the throwback model. They deliver babies. They can even do C-sections. They care for children, adults, geriatrics, really the entire continuum of life. And then pediatrics, the field of pediatrics is also considered primary care. So a general pediatrician will see kids in the office.
And are we seeing shortages in all those areas, or is it one particular area, like internal medicine?
Well, the one I know the best is internal medicine because I help administer the training program at OU. And nationally, about 2% of medical school graduates go into primary care internal medicine, 2%. And it's really less than that. That's the figure that's often quoted. So we have over 1,500, I'm getting the numbers correct, spots nationally. But if you do the math, it's very few that will go. Most of those will go on to subspecialized, and a huge plurality, if not outright majority, will now go on and work in the hospital as a hospitalist.
Yeah.
And that's the problem. There are shortages, too, of family doctors and pediatricians. I don't think they're quite as acute, though, as in internal medicine.
Well, you say, you write in your article about Massachusetts as sort of a model of what we're likely to see in the rest of the country once provisions come into effect. And they've had this for
2006.
Mm-hmm. And the waiting list is pretty high. About half of the practices in Massachusetts are closed to new patients.
That's right. They looked, the Massachusetts Medical Society does an annual update on the healthcare law in Massachusetts. They have a thing called the Connector, which is a state agency. It's really what the Affordable Care Act federally is trying to do with a health insurance exchange. And the Massachusetts Health Connector looks to connect people who now have insurance with primary care in their area. And what they found is that exactly half of all family practice offices and primary care internal medicine offices are closed to new patients, simply can't take more new patients. And so the average wait is on the order of 50 business days to get what they do is they simply sample practices across the state and they call them and they say, hi, I'm a new patient. How long would it take me to get an appointment? And they say, how's 3 months from now? And that's great if you're feeling fine and you just want to establish care. But if you actually want to see the doctor because you have a problem, you probably don't want to wait that long.
Yeah, and you're probably to end up back at the emergency room.
Back at the emergency room, which is what a lot of this was designed to.
Yeah, well, you threw out a term which is what you see a lot of internal medicine new doctors go into, and that's becoming a hospitalist. Now, what is a hospitalist?
A hospitalist is a physician who spends most of his or her time working in the hospital, taking care of hospitalized patients.
Now, is that a private doctor or is he actually working as an employee of the hospital?
So both.
Okay.
They're private doctors, but increasingly over the last 5 years, we've seen more and more of them simply become employed by hospitals. And the reason for that is if they're employees of the hospital has more control, in a sense, over the doctors and how they perform. And hospitals, as I'm sure you know, are now much more beholden to these quality measures, such as length of stay, such as how well do they treat pneumonia, heart attacks, heart failure. And there are all kinds of measurements that they have to send into Medicare, which is the primary payer for most hospitals. And so a hospitalist is someone who spends most of their time working in the hospital. And you could say, well, don't all doctors do that? And the answer is increasingly no. So there's been this dichotomy where in a teaching role, I spend some of my time caring for patients in the hospital, and I do that with residents to teach them and train them and role model good doctoring for them. But I spend most of my time as an office doctor in a what we call a private practice. It's really a faculty practice. And so these doctors that work in the hospital almost exclusively don't have outpatient practices. So once the patient leaves the hospital, it becomes somebody else's problem. They don't follow up the patient. They don't see the patient. And so they're literally stationed in the hospital.
And you also write that they have regular hours. You write that most of these hospitalist doctors will work 7 days on, 7 days off. So if you see the doctor on day five or six of his shift you establish a rapport, all of a sudden he's gone and out of your, you know, just basically his notes from the experience.
That's right. So one of the big attractions to being a hospitalist are these, frankly, financial and lifestyle considerations. So a hospital can earn a multiple more of salary than somebody who does mostly outpatient medicine. And in the article, I quote numbers, and this varies greatly by region of the country, but on average, a hospitalist can earn in the neighborhood of $200,000 a year, whereas an office-based doctor, give or take, is about $150,000. So a significant pay differential. Hospitalists also do this type of shift work where they'll typically work 12-hour shifts for 7 consecutive days. So they work a lot of hours, but then they'll have the subsequent 7 days completely off, out of the hospital, no pager, really no responsibility.
No after-hours calls.
No after-hours calls. Mm-hmm. And so that's very attractive for a lot of people because even though they work roughly the same number of hours, the amount of time they spend in the hospital and the amount of free time they feel like they have is greatly enhanced. And if you're a parent or you want to moonlight and make money in other ways or you want to travel or you know, to the good, if you want to volunteer, which a lot of physicians do, work in free clinics or do other kinds of charitable work, you have more time available with which to do that. So it is a very attractive lifestyle.
It seems like the salary, you know, attractors are sort of flipped on their head based on how a consumer would look at it. A consumer would look at it as the primary care is seeing all these patients across the course of a day. He should be paid more. It should be, you know, he's putting out his own shingle as opposed to working under the umbrella of a hospital.
Well, you're right. And there's a lot of commentary out there in the medical literature world.
Is that due to insurance reimbursement rates for the most part?
It has pretty much everything to do with that. So the way that healthcare is financed is driven by what Medicare does, and private insurers follow suit. But typically, what we call cognitive specialties, that is this evaluation and management services. So a patient comes in, I examine them, I think about it, and I come up with a plan. That's called evaluation and management. Whereas if I do a procedure that might only take 5 or 10 minutes, like I inject a knee or aspirate a joint or remove a mole, I actually get paid more for the shorter time to do the procedure than I would to do the what might even be complex thinking. Let's say, for example, it's a geriatric patient where there's dementia or there's care-at-home issues to take care of or to be arranged, or even if for someone at the end of life, which is, again, another sort of political quagmire. But having these really meaningful and important discussions about what someone's preferences are for how much care they would even want, were they to get critically ill, would they want to come in the hospital, et cetera, that's not really reimbursed at a very high level at all. And so it winds up that the office-based doctor does, in fact, get reimbursed less for his or her time.
And there's a lot more paperwork. I think that's one thing your article talks about is the one the doctor uses as an example. She really loves that idea of, you know, dealing with a patient, knowing that she's there for that patient and having that relationship. But it's also, you see patients all day, you're dealing with paperwork and IT now with all the medical records on computer now and computerized records. Then she goes home and she does more paperwork. And that hospitalist is probably not doing that?
Right. The hospitalist will do, I mean, the hospitalist is beholden and does have an obligation to do the documentation that an outpatient doctor would also do, because ultimately it's our documentation that demonstrates our level of thinking and therefore what we can charge or bill for the service that's rendered. So the inpatient, the hospital doctor, still has that same obligation. The issue is that they can do it all on the premises in the hospital and sort of develop their own workflow. And if it takes them an hour to see a patient, it takes them an hour. If they have a follow-up visit for a patient that's already in the hospital, it might take 5 or 10 minutes, and bim, bam, boom, they're done. The outpatient doctor still has kind of the same level of burdensome documentation that has to conform to a certain way. And as you pointed out, there are all kinds of mandates being handed down about how we use information technology, again, with good intentions, but lots of unintended consequences about, you know, computer bugs and not being logical the way a doctor thinks and having to check off lots of boxes in order to produce this documentation. So it really does put an administrative burden on the doctors, and it seems to fall, unfortunately, more on the outpatient doctors, because the hospital doctors just are better resource. There's more people around to help fix their computers when they break. The hospital will take on the huge investment cost of the computer system, whereas in the private doctor's world, the doctor, him or herself, or the practice has to make that capital investment. Now, there will be some reimbursement from the government if they adopt the so-called meaningful use criteria, but that's kind of a bunch of gobbledygook.
My guest today is Dr. John Schumann, Associate Professor of Medicine at OU Tulsi at the School of Community Medicine. And he's also the Associate Director of the Internal Medicine Residency Program at OU Tulsa. He's the author of an article in The Atlantic documenting the shortage in primary care physicians. Well, you know, you've sort of laid out the case. This is, why would anybody go into primary care, outpatient primary care, as opposed to working in a hospital?
Yeah.
You know, the hours are better. The pay is a little better. The paperwork's maybe a little less. No middle-of-the-night phone calls.
So far, so good, right? Why would you choose it? Well, there are a few reasons. But as you correctly point out, if you're making a rational choice, economically speaking, it makes much more sense to work in the hospital where the system is more supportive and you have all those other benefits that you mentioned. It takes a certain kind of person. I should say the pendulum will often swing. So I graduated from medical school in 1997, which was really the zenith of emphasis on careers in primary care. And I was literally told by my medical school that if I went into a field like anesthesia or radiology, I would not find a job. And on the face of it, at this point, that seems ludicrous because we're churning out tons of anesthesiologists and radiologists. Those residency slots are extremely competitive. Our best graduates with our highest scores go into those fields. And again, for lifestyle reasons, those are usually have set hours. They are highly paid specialties. So people are voting with their feet, so to speak, and they're looking at what primary care doctors do and saying, I don't want the headache, I don't want the hassle, all the hours, as you point out. Why would somebody do it? Well, it has to do really with, I think, you know, finding meaningful work. And I think that primary care doctors, by and large, do find what they do to be extremely meaningful, having long-term, longitudinal relationships with patients over many years or decades. The relationship between a hospitalist and his or her patient is days at most. And, for example, another site-specific specialty, emergency medicine, that relationship is hours to minutes, frankly. And so I'm not saying that that's bad. That would be bad for me personally because I actually value the continuity and the longevity of the relationship. But different strokes for different folks, but it's a different thing altogether. And so the person that's going to go into primary care is going to know enough about themselves in a sense to understand that there's value in that long-term relationship and certainly that it's not about the money. So you have to be able to discount that. And people have a harder time doing that when they have educational loans in the six-figure neighborhood. The average medical student loan is the average medical student graduates with more than $150,000 in educational debt. So it's a lot. I mean, not that other students don't, but it's just the enormity of it is huge because it's 4 years and very
and
expensive.
There's probably loans in their undergraduate and medical school as well.
And they pile up.
Yeah, they do pile up. So given that situation, I want to talk about something you alluded to and we didn't quite go to is when you're talking about the role of the hospitalist. In the old days, if you had an internal medicine primary care doctor, if you were hospitalized, you really expected to see that doctor in the hospital, at least checking on you. There might be other doctors that would look at you, but you would expect to see that. It sounds like from your article, there's a trend where those doctors are not going to the hospital because the hospital has its own doctors it wants you to see.
That's right. So two things happened. One was hospitals saw these quality measures coming down the pike, and they said, we know that we're going to get docked pay, doctor reimbursement, if our patients stay too long in the hospital. So how can we keep our patients in the hospital a shorter time? Well, it turns out...
Oh, this sounds very sinister.
It's sinister, all right. You're looking for efficiency models. And one of the ways you're more efficient, in the old version you mentioned, if I'm the doctor, I come in early in the morning, I round up my hospital patients, I go to my office from 8 to 5, I see a bunch of patients all day, I come back at 5:30, 6 o'clock, maybe to discharge you, maybe to think about, that's a long day for one thing. But if the nurses need me throughout the day, there's really not a doctor, there might be a specialist on staff, but if I'm the primary attending physician for that hospitalized patient, I'm not there, I'm not present to actually make decisions and help kind of move that patient along. So the hospitals got smart and said, hey, if we have doctors that are here, we can be a lot more efficient. And even though it sounds sinister, patients actually like it. They like the idea that their doctor, even though they love their office doctor, the doctor they've had for many years, and they would vastly prefer to have that doctor come to the hospital to take care of them, they're, by and large, in the satisfaction studies, they're pretty happy with the hospitalist because the hospitalist is there. They have a pain, they have a need, the nurse says, well, I better call the doctor. It turns out that doctor's right there on the premises.
Right.
And sure enough, when they did the research or have done the research and keep doing it, hospitalists provide value in shortening the length of stay, improving the quality of care and the safety of care. So from a hospital viewpoint, this is a must. And then from a patient viewpoint, to be honest, I mean, having better quality and better safety is a good.
Yeah.
And then having a lower cost to the hospitalization probably is a good, although if insurance is paying for it, you don't necessarily care so much.
My mind was thinking about, you know, here's a doctor that really has no strong tie to this patient, as opposed to your primary care doctor who says, you could probably use another day.
Well, you have that exactly right. I mean, there's no doubt about that. If you're working for the hospital, I mean, we doctors all like to think we're working for the patient. And this comes up a lot, too. Who are we really working for? Are we working for the hospital? Are we working for the insurer? I mean, heaven forbid we think we're working for the insurer. But this is something that comes up a lot. And if you're right, if you're a hospital employee, you may do what you think is medically best, but you have that little bug in the back of your ear saying, you know, length of stay. You, the physician, you don't want to be the outlier amongst your peers or amongst the other departments. You're incredibly targeted. You get all the data and these graphs and charts and things. And
yeah, and if you keep everybody a day too long, then you're at the bottom of the class.
That's right. Yeah. And you can you know, all the way from not getting performance bonuses to, you know, losing your job ultimately.
Yeah. So is that the drawback? Is that one of the drawbacks of this system?
So the big drawback, and I find there's sort of an older-younger split. I mean, older patients who've had it the other way, where they've had their doctor come to the hospital, they're disheartened by this. Now, there are exceptions, of course, and patients I've cared for in the hospital have been very satisfied with the hospital system. And it's not altogether sinister. And I didn't mention the other side of that coin, which was the outpatient doctor now not having to go to the hospital twice a day was much more efficient in his or her office, able to see more patients, not be uprooted or not have to make a lot of phone calls. And so the efficiencies on both sides of the equation worked better. The hospitalist thing worked really well in group practices where one member of the group who knew most of the patients and who knew his or her colleagues would be able to do the hospital rounding that week or that month. As the hospitals have gotten larger and hired more and more of the doctors, there's been sort of a rupture between the hospital physicians and the primary care practices to where they're not really on the same team anymore. And so there is a real breakdown in communication. And it is a particular problem. And we see this. I've seen this in, you know, three different cities. And I would say Tulsa's not that different. At OU, for example, where we have a faculty practice, we have our own faculty who serve as hospitalists for our patients. So the communication tends to be very good.
Yeah. My guest today is Dr. John Schumann, an associate professor of medicine at OU Tulsa and the author of an article in The Atlantic documenting the shortage in primary care physicians. So how do we change this? Because we're going to see more people with insurance. They're going to need primary care physicians. If 2% of, you know, doctors coming out are going into primary care, it sounds like you're going to be losing more doctors from retirement than you're going to be replacing.
Yeah, I mean, this huge bottleneck is coming, and that's really why I wrote the article and why I think the editor, you know, wanted to run it, because we're a couple of years away from this big problem. And so the solutions that are offered are many. For one thing, a lot of people say, and maybe correctly, maybe not, I don't know, but that internal medicine physicians who spend about 2/3 of their 3-year training period working in the hospital are very good at hospital medicine. And in fact, that's what they should be doing, is working in the hospital. Maybe I shouldn't be doing primary care. Maybe my training is too much or So that's one consideration. So maybe the nurse practitioners and the physician assistants, which are these growing classes of what we call mid-level professionals, nurses with advanced training and this relatively new category of physician assistants, get training. They have shorter training periods, but they learn a lot more through internships and on-the-job training. They also have this term physician extender, which I don't like, but they extend physicians. They work under the supervision of a medical doctor, and so they can work in the outpatient practices to see these outpatients. Family medicine is seen mostly as an outpatient specialty since they cover the span of life, and it does make more economic sense if you're a mother with two kids and you want to just get all of you seen at the doctor at the same time. It is much more efficient than having a separate doctor for the mom and one for each kid and that type of a thing. So we're talking about vastly expanding the pool of nurse practitioners, physician assistants. The other thing we have to do really is change the incentives. We have to value primary care. We have to value cognitive services. And that requires really heavy political lifting, trying to change the financing and payment structure for medicine. And there's a lot of political push to do that. But if it's a single pie question, the specialists are at the table saying, well, I don't really want to give back a slice of my pie. Why should it come out of my pie to give more to the primary care doctor? So that's a political battle that's hard to see. The last thing would be government incentives. So like the National Health Service Corps, where the government says, hey, you got that $150,000 in loans. We're glad to forgive your loans. Go work in an underserved area. Go work in primary care in an underserved. Frankly, every city is going to be an underserved area. We usually think about the rural areas or the Native American reservations, but we're talking about cities where people aren't going to be able to find a doctor.
Mm. And I know that's something that's very much involved with the School of Community Medicine, too.
We're really working toward trying to create new paradigms in how we're going to train all kinds of professionals, not just doctors, to work to try to address this problem both at an individual patient level and a community-wide level.
And, there's a lot of people who say we can't take any ideas from European healthcare, but that is one of the big tenets of European healthcare is a lot of times when you become a doctor and, you're not going to make as much money, but you're going to have different incentives than just straight money. And like I know in France, I believe in Germany, there are different incentives for becoming a doctor, and some of that involves forgiving the loans or for not having the loans in the first place.
Right. So where like state sponsored education would go a long way toward alleviating this. In other words, if we were able to either forgive the loans or not have people have to take these enormous educational burdens, people would feel more free to choose what they want or stick with the idealistic principles that got them to medical school in the first place.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see, and I know you have more Atlantic articles coming on this subject.
Well, they're in development. A lot of people wrote in asking, in the article, because I happened to leave out those solutions, and we sort of made an editorial decision. I wanted to just state the problem and see if the readership would offer some solutions. I mentioned some of them to you here in these comments, and I'm actually developing a piece on physician assistants because OU is the first chance I've had to really work closely with physician assistant students. And right now, I think it's a great program, and I'd like to see it go forward. I want to learn more about it, and in doing so, kind of share knowledge with the readers.
All right, and we'll look forward to your comments here on Studio Tulsa as well from time to time. Dr. John Schumann, thanks very much for joining us.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Dr. John Schumann is an associate professor of medicine at OU Tulsa's School of Community Medicine and the associate director of their internal medicine residence program and the author of the article in this month's issue of The Atlantic on the shortage of primary care internal physicians. He's also our commentator on health and medicine issues here on Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.